More than 2 million Texans showed up to vote, but some of them had to wait for hours to cast a ballot. Voter suppression or mismanagement? That today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm Nathan Bernier in for David Brown. Now that the primary results are in, how useful were the polls leading up to the election? We'll hear from one of the pollsters at the University of Texas, plus the growing number of Democrats who say Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders needs to pick a woman as a running mate. Coronavirus fears harming businesses from Houston's Chinatown to Austin's South by Southwest. And what's it like to be a U.S. soldier deployed to the U.S. border with Mexico? All that and more on today's edition of the Texas Standard, coming up right after this. No matter where you are, it is Texas Standard time on this March 5th, 2020. I'm Nathan Bernier in for David Brown on the day after Super Tuesday. Finally, people watching closely have managed to get some sleep and digest the results and take a closer look at some of the problems, like why did voters at a historically black university in Houston, Texas Southern, wind up having to wait hours after the polls closed to cast their ballots? That wasn't the only place with long waits, but we're going to talk about that more a little bit later in the program. The dominoes have started to fall. Reports now that Elizabeth Warren is dropping out of the race for the Democratic presidential nomination. But let's turn our attention to the field of a dozen Democratic candidates hoping to challenge the senior United States Senator from Texas, Republican John Cornyn. Took a while for the results to be completely ironed out, but now that field has narrowed to two. Former Air Force helicopter pilot and Central Texan MJ Hager and North Texas State Senator Royce West will face each other in a runoff election in late May. In fact, mark these dates down on your calendar. The primary elections, the runoff elections, are May 26. Early voting starts May 18th. As the Texas Standard's Jill Ament reports, it was known early on after Tuesday's primary election, this U.S. Senate primary would go to a runoff, with Hager still being the one to beat.
State Senator Royce West started pulling ahead of labor activist Christina Sinzun Ramirez by a mere percentage point late Wednesday. The two were neck and neck for much of Super Tuesday night after the polls closed. Ramirez conceded early yesterday evening.
I'm proud of the race we ran. I ran as a woman, a Latina, a working mom, a progressive that got spent, you know, outspent 4-1 by MJ Hager and came in a very close third to the incredible Senator Royce West.
Ramirez says despite the race for second being very close between her and West, her campaign didn't want to call a recount.
As we saw the full tallies come in, and as big as it is in Texas and as expensive as it is to do a recount, this felt like the best way forward to look at the results we had and allow the two candidates to move forward and allow Texas voters to get down to business with the runoff.
Meanwhile, West, the longtime state senator from Dallas, is gearing up for another tough matchup with Hager. Hager gained both statewide and national attention in the 2018 midterm election for a surprisingly close margin loss to longtime Central Texas Republican Congressman John Carter. But that loss didn't stop her from being one of the first candidates to launch a campaign to unseat Cornyn. Hager quickly got the endorsement from the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. The move drew criticism from others in the race, including West and Ramirez. Even so, Hager also out-fundraised her opponents. At his primary night watch party on Tuesday, Senator West told reporters he knows he's got his work cut out for him again.
Yes, we're going to have to raise money. Yes, the Democratic National Campaign Committee has put its thumb on it and given a person the advantage without even interviewing other persons. But, you know the story of David and Goliath. I will end up being David.
Renee Cross is senior director of the Hobby School of Public Affairs at the University of Houston. She agrees going into the runoff, Hager has the advantage over Senator West.
Between higher recognition, strong support around among Anglo women who are demographic most likely to turn out to vote, and you know, especially in a May election, and the fact that Hager may be able to access more money for a statewide campaign, I would say that she has the upper hand.
But Cross says not to discount West's ability to catch up, especially in a primary runoff election.
He's got support among the older voters who tend to vote. But West has been around for a very long time, and those in Dallas-Fort Worth know him, area know him quite well. Plus, he has a lot of ties to the other urban areas in Texas.
Hagar, who gained more than 22% of the vote on primary night, continues to position herself as the strongest candidate in the runoff and beyond. Her campaign said in a statement on Wednesday she was the, quote, clear front runner to take on Cornyn in November. For the Texas Standard, I'm Jill Ament, reporting in Austin.
After the 2016 general election, so many people were like, I'm not putting all this faith in political polls anymore. Remember that? But yet in the run-up to Super Tuesday, people were devouring polls. And one pollster was very much in demand in Texas. His name is Joshua Blank, director of research at the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. He spoke with host David Brown on why and if any faith was restored in polls after Super Tuesday.
So let's talk about what we've just experienced with the wave of polls in Texas and what actually happened at the ballot box. How close?
Actually, pretty close, I would say. You know, if we look at Texas, for example, you know, and oftentimes what we want is there's been a huge number of polls in Texas, and that's sort of actually a bit of a new thing. I mean, for a long time, obviously for the last couple decades, Texas has been such an overwhelmingly Republican state that really, I think, it was only myself and a couple other people doing regular polls here. And all of a sudden, if I go and look at sort of the list where they collect these things at the various websites, you know, I can easily rattle off, looks like 15 polls, maybe 20 since April, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of interest down here. And that's great because, I mean, one of the things that I think anyone who's an expert will tell you is that, you know what's better than a poll? The average of a couple polls. Because they're all samples, and they're all snapshots in time. And if you look at the average across those polls, they were about half a point off of where Sanders ended up. They were about 3 points off of where Bloomberg ended up. They were about 3 points off of where Warren ended up, which would all be somewhere within the margin of error, generally, mm-hmm. of polling. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The only person who really overperformed in Texas, and really in a lot of states, was Joe Biden. But the reality is that every poll is a snapshot in time. And
a whole lot of change happened in those last 24 hours right before Super Tuesday.
Yeah, the Democratic establishment basically lined up behind Joe Biden and said, this is the guy.
One of the things that I think this race may have done, and you correct me if I'm wrong here, I have a sense that perhaps faith in polls or confidence in the polls has been somewhat restored, or no.
Oh, geez. I don't know. I think I could go two ways with that. I mean, I think on the one hand, there's been more and more high quality polling in an increased number of states, I think.
And a whole lot more scrutiny, too.
A whole lot more scrutiny. There's higher standards, I think. You know, I think journalists have been a lot more explicit about what requirements they have before they'll publish a poll. And by requirements, I mean the type of disclosure that a pollster has to go through about how they did the process. A certain amount of transparency is necessary. Mm-hmm. I think there's a little bit less of just taking polls on faith that they were well done. But I think there's more people actually doing good work.
I want to talk with you about something that is sort of the lift the curtain just a little bit on how these polls work. And I think transparency is good for the entire process. You gather the numbers, and there is understood, I mean, if you understand the way that the science works, the bell curve, the normal distribution curve, you begin to sort of tweak based on certain assumptions about the way politics works in the United States or in a particular jurisdiction. How much do you think that the tweaking of those assumptions affect ultimately the numbers that we see and that we repeat on the air?
Oh, I mean, it definitely does. I mean, the reality is the world's a complicated place. And so if we're going to make any sort of model of the world, whether it's politics or anything else, we have to make assumptions. We just can't progress. And the idea is all models are wrong. Some are useful. There's a famous statistician who said that, and that's true. And we're talking about here a model of the world. You know, the New York Times did something a couple years back where they collected data themselves in a survey and then gave it to four pollsters and said, here's the data, do what you want to do with it and give us your estimates. And they were all a little bit different. And what I mean they're different is they all produce slightly different results in terms of the ballot, but they also produce different compositions of the underlying electorate. And that's really what we're talking about here when we're talking about assumptions. I mean, go back a step and we start off by finding a list of all the people that, you know, are in the universe of interest. So in this case, you know, in a state like Texas, you buy a list of registered voters. It doesn't say who voted, like how people voted, but we know when they voted, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And you start there, and then people start to call that down and say, well, who's a likely voter on this list? And then there's some mix of people who always vote in every election, people who vote in some elections. And then you, I mean, this is how you start to, you know, think about the art of this, is you start to think, well, who do we really think is going to show up out of this list? And it's difficult, right? I mean, it's a challenge because we don't exactly know what share of the electorate is going to, let's say the Democratic primary electorate, for example, is going to be African-American. We can look historically. Mm-hmm. We can see what the trends look like. We can look at changes in the population and make, you know, slight adjustments. But really, if you're doing a good faith effort, you're making slight adjustments,
yeah,
ever so slightly. But then that produces slight adjustments in the ultimate end product.
They start to compound, really, once you get to a certain point.
Yeah, but I think for the most part, I think if people are, you know, if people are well-trained, they know what they're doing, which there are a lot of them, and they make good faith efforts to kind of follow standard practices for how you do this, they're not so far off. And usually when you do see something where you see one result that's just, you know, way out from the other, it's called an outlier, right?
Outlier.
You go back, especially in election contests, which is really what people are most interested in, and you look at the composition of the electorate that result relies on, and mm-hmm, usually it's going to look pretty different than most of the others. But this is where it's a little bit of an art and not just a science, is that, you know, I can't tell you what the composition of the electorate in Texas is going to look like in November of 2020. I have ideas. I know what it's looked like historically.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyone who says this is the share of the electorate that's going to be Hispanic is making an assumption.
Very interesting conversation with Joshua Blank. You can trust this guy. He is director of research at the Texas Politics Project, and he knows a thing or two about polls. The Texas Politics Project, of course, is at the University of Texas at Austin. Dr. Blank, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Social media editor Wells Dunbar with a look at what people are talking about online. What's up?
Hey, Nathan. Good to see you, man. Well, the big news online, the story breaking Thursday morning, Senator Elizabeth Warren ending her bid for the Democratic presidential nomination following a disappointing series of results on Super Tuesday. Lots of fans of hers that voted in the Democratic primary sounding off via Twitter. Anna tells us that we really need her fighting spirit, her endurance energy, and her positive attitude. I hope our new president values her strength and gives her a position in the cabinet. Another user, ND, tweets us that she's sad and angry, mostly sad. I'll vote for whoever the Democratic Party nominates because electing someone other than Trump is important to me, but it'll be a not Trump vote, not a yes this person vote. Many similar remarks coming in from her supporters online, demoralized at the news. But, you know, that's just one story we're watching, Nathan. We'll be back with more later in the show.
All right, Wells know what you're thinking. We're at Texas Standard on Twitter and Facebook. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where Horned Frogs strive to be responsible world citizens. More on how a trip to Norway challenged students' perspectives on mass incarceration and justice at tcu.edu/stories.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Nathan Bernier in for David Brown. Businesses in Chinatown districts across the country are suffering from unfounded fears about the novel coronavirus and a misunderstanding of the risks. This includes a Chinatown district in the largest city in Texas. Houston Public Media's Florian Martin reports.
About a dozen Chinese restaurants and bistros line the strip mall anchored by a Just Go supermarket on Ballard Boulevard in far southwest Houston. Usually, it's hard to find a parking spot here, but for the past few weeks, the problem has been there are too many open ones, and the restaurants here are feeling it. On a recent weeknight, many of them were empty or nearly empty, like Tainan Bistro. Owner Ming Shu was sitting at a table by himself doing paperwork.
We lost the business over 60%.
Over 60% business lost, he says, since a rumor started circulating on Chinese social media last month. It falsely claimed the Just Go supermarket had to close due to a case of the coronavirus there, and people stopped coming.
It's not because of virus, it's because of rumor.
In the other corner of the strip mall, Mala Sichuan Bistro is about half full.
It's not typical.
Owner Corey Zhang says her business has been down anywhere from 35 to 60% since the social media rumor.
We've had to decrease the shifts of our employees and then had to temporarily lay off two of the kitchen crew.
At least on this day, there's a full table of people at Mala Sichuan and three other restaurants in the area. The diners are members of the Entrepreneurs Organization, who've decided to take a couple of lunches and dinners in Chinatown to support businesses here. Adam Brackman came up with the idea. He's one of the partners who run Axelrad Beer Garden in Midtown.
We all get together for lunches or dinners, and so I said, hey, let's get together and have as many members as we can come out here and eat. I think it's really important that we as Estonians get out here and support as many of these businesses as you can.
But the issue doesn't seem to be with people outside of Chinatown shying away. Mala Sichuan owner Zhang says fewer Chinese people are coming.
Right now you can see that we do not have any single group that is Chinese only. This table, it's got one Chinese person, but the other three are non-Chinese. And then the other table over there has also one Asian person with a white person. So we're not seeing any, like, just Chinese families today.
In fact, she says, since the coronavirus rumors started, more non-Chinese people have come. Zhang attributes this to Chinese social media.
The Chinese people, they're more active in WeChat, which is a chat app that every Chinese person uses. And there's a lot of media circulation going on in that community. So when people hear more about it, they're more afraid of it.
Public officials have recognized this too. Almost immediately after the social media rumors started affecting Chinatown, elected leaders came out to dispel them. State Representative Jin Wu directly addressed the Asian American community.
Whether you're on WeChat, whether you're on Instagram or Twitter, if you are spreading false information about your own community, you are doing harm to your community.
But now, still no improvement in Chinatown. Hans Stockton teaches East Asian Studies at the University of St. Thomas. He says distrust of the government in the Asian community doesn't help.
I think there might be a natural doubt about the power of validity of WeChat versus elected officials who might be perceived as having jobs that obligate them to tell us everything is okay.
Back at Mala Sichuan, owner Zhang says she hopes Texas will continue to stay virus-free and that things will return to normal this spring.
Then people will just be like, okay, it's kind of scary, but then there's like, look, there's no more new cases, then I think we're fine.
I'm Florian Martin in Houston.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. We have a list going in the newsroom here at KUT Austin of all of the companies that are canceling appearances and events at South by Southwest because of concerns about the novel coronavirus. This list includes some big names you've probably heard of before. Apple, Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, Netflix, IBM, Warner Media, which is like CNN, HBO, Cinemax. Yesterday, public health officials in Austin said there's no evidence that canceling South by Southwest would make the capital city any safer from the coronavirus. The event begins March 13th, takes over much of downtown Austin, but it's not just South by. Google and Facebook have been canceling some of their own annual conferences. Smaller events around the country are facing some uncertainty. Our tech expert Omar Gayaga has been watching the rapidly unfolding impact of the coronavirus and the worries about it on tech industry gatherings. Hello there, Omar.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. What's happening with South by in Austin?
Well, we're taking a wait. We're waiting to see what's going to happen. I mean, there is still the possibility a little over a week out that it could still be canceled or significantly scaled back. I mean, it's going to be scaled back whether the organizers want to or not, because these companies are pulling out. The activations, panels, attendees, a lot of individual attendees, you know, that are pretty high profile are posting that they are not coming. So we're seeing panel after panel go down and you know, these big scale kind of gatherings and activations from companies like CNN or Amazon Studios, they're not going to be here.
When the companies announce they're canceling, how are they describing their concerns? Because there have been no confirmed cases in Central Texas.
Yeah, due to an abundance of caution is right. How they typically begin. It's pretty serious. And this has been going on with not just South by Southwest, but every major tech event has had to kind of do some soul searching and figure out if they're going to continue. I mean, it started with the mobile World Conference in Barcelona, which is a gigantic, you know, mobile technology conference, that was canceled. And then Game Developers Conference, IBM's Think Conference, Google I/O is not going to be now going to be an online event. So it's happening with pretty much every major tech event, except for South by Southwest, which they have said that they will cancel if the city advises them to. Hmm. So we're waiting to see if we kind of fall over that edge.
But right now, the city of Austin, the officials they don't think it's really a requirement.
The argument I heard was, you know, these people are coming anyway, which maybe
some
not
of them
so
aren't coming anyway.
So we're waiting to see. And I mean, you know, we're not just talking about the people that have badges, which is, you know, in the 40,000-50,000 range. We're talking about last year, it was 417,400 people who attended all South by Southwest events.
Almost
nearly half a million people, with an economic impact of about $355 million. So it's a big deal. It's a big gathering.
Well, as someone who lives in Austin, I hear of people, you know, the person who was going to rent their Airbnb canceled. There's all these knock-on economic
impacts. It trickles down to all the businesses, all the, you know, the venues that make most of their money for the year during South by Southwest. I mean, it's going to impact a lot of people beyond just the people attending the conference.
So if you were... or responsible for a bunch of employees who might attend South by Southwest, how would you recommend they approach travel to Austin for a large tech conference? How should people be thinking about this? Is there really a risk?
A lot of companies are just shutting it down, just saying, don't go, stay home. You know, some companies are asking employees not even to come into work, to just telecommute. So I think, you know, we're going to, over the next week, it could get much, much worse. And I think if it does, then that will definitely factor into the decision of should they just cancel it entirely or postpone it.
But South by Southwest must have some kind of insurance or something.
I believe they have event insurance.
I mean, like the organizers, how concerned are they?
I mean, you know, having spoken to them a lot over the years, I mean, they spend the entire year planning for this, of the logistics of getting the speakers lined up and who's going to be here. I mean, we have people like Hillary Clinton coming. I mean, like big, big deal speakers and celebrities and musicians. And, you know, it's a lot to try to reorganize or reschedule.
Tech expert Omar Gallega on coronavirus fears around South by Southwest in Austin. Thank you so much, Omar.
Thank you for having me in studio and not making me telecommute this.
Yes, and we didn't shake hands, for the record.
We are not touching.
This is the Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Houston area health officials are waiting for more test results after identifying the first presumptive positive case of the novel coronavirus outside of quarantine in Texas. Fort Bend County Health Director Dr. Jacqueline Johnson-Minter described the patient Wednesday.
This person is a man in his 70s who traveled abroad and became ill after his return to the U.S.
In the Austin area, health officials say they're awaiting test results for one or more people who may have the illness. Meanwhile, Dallas County, which has no confirmed cases of COVID-19, says it has the first lab in Texas that can test for coronavirus. Governor Greg Abbott is asking more than 500,000 Texas educators to weigh in on what their schools need to prevent shootings. Texas Public Radio's Lauren Terrazas reports the survey launched Wednesday.
It'll be used to gather information on school preparedness for active shooter situations and natural disasters. The initiative will be the largest needs assessment on school safety in the state's history. The results will be used to better inform lawmakers on how they can support the needs of educators regarding safety, mental health, and violence in schools. I'm Lauren Terrazas in San Antonio.
Starting Monday, all cases of detained unaccompanied children at the Houston Immigration Court will be heard via video teleconference. The pilot program could deny due process to nearly 1,500 children, according to the advocacy group Kids in Need of Defense. Policy Director Jason Boyd says the practice forces attorneys to choose whether to be with their clients in Houston or...
Attorneys can appear in the Atlanta courtroom, where the immigration judge and ICE attorney are located. In doing so, attorneys forego the option to confer confidentially with their clients, running the risk that children make uninformed decisions with far-reaching consequences for their futures.
Boyd says the federal government should abandon the pilot program. New data from the U.S. Census Bureau shows communities in the Permian Basin are struggling to recruit workers to ensure an accurate population count. Katie Martin Lightfoot is the Census Community Engagement Coordinator at the Center for Public Policy Priorities. She says the Census Bureau tries to hire local residents to promote participation.
So folks that know the community, look like the community, sound like they're from the community. And it's that hope that when people see that, they see that the woman on the street is coming to their door to answer, to fill out the census questionnaire, the person is more likely to open the door and respond.
Midland and Ector counties have reached roughly 60% of their census worker staffing goals. I'm Joseph Leahy.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Abilene Christian University. Focusing on student success within key areas like service learning, first-year experiences, and learning communities. More at acu.edu.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Nathan Bernier in for David Brown. More than 2 million people voted in the Texas primaries, about 13% turnout. In this race where Joe Biden secured a narrow win over second place Bernie Sanders. And of course, there are races determined up and down the ballot. And we were here late in the newsroom on election night watching as reports streamed in of polling stations still processing voters hours after the polls had closed. Maybe you were stuck in one of those lines yourself. It's become a national story at this point. There's a headline in the New York Times that asks, why did it take so long to vote in Texas and California? Some people in Harris County waited 6 hours or more to vote, like at Texas Southern University, a historically black institution in Houston. So what's behind this? Is it voter suppression or mismanagement? Here with insights from the left, Chad Dunn, general counsel for the Texas Democratic Party. Mr. Dunn, welcome to the Texas Standard, sir.
Thank you.
So Texas has closed more polling places than any other state. Democrats have argued that it disproportionately affects minority voters. Why?
What happened here is that a few years back, Democrats had been lobbying the legislature to try to go to what's called vote centers. You know, it used to be the case you had to vote at the polling location by your house. Early voting could be done anywhere in the county, but for some reason, for years and years on election day, you still had to go to that polling location at your house. So Democratic members of the legislature wanted to make it easier to where you, on a, election day you could vote anywhere just like you could the other 2 weeks of early voting. Republican members of the House and Senate were opposed to that idea, at least initially. And after some negotiations, a compromise was reached. And that compromise was, if we close down a number of local polling locations, then we'll agree to go to these polling locations that you could go anywhere in the county. So a bargain was struck. Now, there's a second component of it. As part of that bargain, the legislature put together a procedure that said that the both local county chairs had to agree to this process. And so what you saw in Harris County is that the Republican county chair there demanded a number of polling location changes and a number of procedures in place for the election that ultimately resulted in the long lines. Until all levels of government focus on this problem and change their attitude, we're going to continue to see these long lines.
Well, you talk about all levels of government. I mean, the elections are mostly run by county officials. And in areas like Houston, those county officials are mostly Democrats, aren't they?
Well, the county officials have to follow these state laws that were passed in many ways to encourage long lines. I mean, you saw the legislature last session got rid of the mobile voting procedure. They've gotten rid of straight ticket voting, which has demonstrated to substantially decrease the length of lines. I think one of the things we're going to see in November, unless there's some changes, is without straight ticket voting, it's going to take every voter in the state substantially longer. Almost 60% of voters use straight ticket voting in most elections, general elections. So, you know, local officials can only do so much. They are governed by state laws. The state laws are written in such a way, often to encourage long lines in certain parts of the town. They try to work around these as best they can. But I'll give you an example of Harris County. The requirement that because the county chairs have to agree on so much of this stuff, the Republican county chair in Harris County demanded that there be an equal number of machines at every polling location for Democrats and then another machine for Republicans. Now, there's two ways you can avoid this problem. The first is if the county chairs agree, which they do in most places, to have a joint primary then you can set up all the machines in the polling location, put the Democratic ballot on it and the Republican ballot on it, and then whoever shows up gets which ballot they prefer, and all the machines are shared equally. But if the party chairs won't agree, then when you show up at the polling location, on one side of the room's Democratic machines only, on the other side of the room is Republican machine only. And then when the county chairs demand that they be an equal number of machines, then you find yourself in a circumstance where it's a predominantly Republican area of town, there'll be half a dozen Democratic machines on the side of the room that nobody uses. On the other hand, when it's on a predominantly Democratic part of town, which was the case at Texas Southern University, you have all these Republican machines sitting there unused while people are standing in line.
But in Harris County,
these things are by choice.
Right, but in Harris County, I mean, those voting machines, some of them are quite old, and I understand that also contributed to some of the delays there.
There's no question that we need to modernize our election equipment. You know, I think the counties are working on that. In my opinion, could they work faster? Absolutely. But, you know, the situation that happened in Harris County was a deliberate choice to not work together under our state laws to run an election that eliminates lines. And we could decide to do that. It's really that simple. We just have to get up and decide as political leadership, we're going to make it as easy to vote and eliminate these lines, and we can do that. It can be done. It's not being done because certain leadership in the state doesn't want it to happen.
Chad Dunn is the general counsel for the Texas Democratic Party. Thanks so much for joining us, Chad.
All right, thank you.
And tomorrow we hope to hear from the Republican Party of Texas, so stay tuned.
Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com, available in the dairy aisle. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, with a reminder that March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. Screening can lead to early detection and is recommended for all men and women age 50 and older. More at texasoncology.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Nathan Bernier in for David Brown. Wearing boots can be a family thing. For our segment called From Heel to Toe, Stories About Texans and Their Boots, many of you have reached out to us to tell us the story of how you got your boots from a relative that is no longer alive. But sometimes boots can be a family statement that we do together right here and right now.
My name is Bree.
And my name is Prophet TV.
And we're the Gazillionaires.
Yeah, we currently have an album out. It's Levitate.
We started out as friends and just built our relationship.
We were kind of inseparable. Mm-hmm. We're partners in a lot of things. We have a couple of businesses. Mm-hmm. But far and foremost, we have a family. We've got a daughter and twins on the way. So we're living life, loving life, and just trying to levitate with this album, you know. I am from Texas. We have Texas roots. The boots just come in a factor. It goes back to, you know, my parents. They used to like to dress up like cowboys and cowgirls, and they would go out on the town. But leaving Texas and now coming back, just appreciating my culture, I like my boots.
I think it's more about just that fashion and they're like, you know, being able to dress it up and have a little swag. Or
when you get a pair of boots, I feel like it's portraying, you know, what your art is or what you like, maybe your favorite color or a shape on it. When you make your pair your own, you really feel in place here, yes. I guess, you know? Right now, too, I guess there are some rappers that are doing that. You got, like, Old Town Road, Lil Nas X. Shout out to him for having a big record last year. Putting his twist on how a cowboy should sing, I guess. It's awesome to have that expression.
I got the horses in the back. Horse stock is attached. Head is matted black. Got the boots is black to match. Riding on a horse.
These are some Ariat. We both have a matching pair.
I think it comes from my military background.
That's right.
Yes,
go Navy.
I did Navy 4 years in Japan. So I just love the fact that it represents the flag and then also the military print on there. So mixing those two together and then having those colors, the light brown, dark brown, and then the beige color, it just really makes those boots stand out.
That's right.
Yeah, we love to dress up and stand out and look good when we make appearances, and having these boots really set it off. It's a good conversation piece. I'm Bree.
And I'm John. I go by Prophet TV.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard.
Tell us your boot story by emailing texasstandard@kut.org. Thousands of military troops remain deployed at the U.S.-Mexico border as part of an effort to prevent illegal crossings. Some of them are active duty service members, but many are part of the National Guard from states as far away as Iowa and Kentucky. It is an unusual deployment. Troops are quartered in hotels and families are allowed to visit. So for the American Homefront Project, Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame reports from McAllen.
In a darkened room inside the McAllen Border Patrol Station, a couple of National Guard troops are bathed in violet glare. Ahead of them is a wall of screens, each displaying camera feeds from different parts of the border. Using motion sensors and control towers, the guard can see vehicles, terrain, and occasionally people. Every so often, they spot something suspicious, like someone hauling drug bundles or trying to cross the border illegally. Then they'll report it to the Border Patrol.
To be advised, I have two scouts on an ATV. They're making their rounds on the south side. And I also have a pickup with probably about four bodies.
A short distance away in Havana, Texas, Border Patrol Agent Herman Rivera hears a call like this, pulls his truck over, and disappears into the brush along the border.
They're right below the tree right there. So we're trying to get behind him.
Within minutes, he and other Border Patrol agents have handcuffed four people trying to cross. Since 2014, National Guard troops have been a regular presence on the U.S. southern border. There are now some 1,700 in Texas alone.
We're filling crucial gaps for CBP, for Border Patrol. We're here so we can allow them to focus on their law enforcement job.
Major Mike Perry is a public affairs officer with the Texas National Guard.
We're providing infrastructure, operational, aerial support, information and detection.
It's unclear how often guardsmen actually contribute to apprehensions or whether their presence has helped drive down the number of crossings. Since troop levels ticked up in April 2018, the number of migrant crossings has fluctuated widely, partly in response to seasonal shifts and federal policy changes. Still, this isn't your typical military deployment. Guardsmen stationed along the border live in government-contracted housing during their deployments, which usually last a few months. For most, that means staying in hotels, which are covered by a per diem of about $150.
Morning, Dad. They have bacon, egg, tamal.
One February morning, several uniformed guardsmen ate continental breakfast at a La Quinta Inn that's become their temporary home. Some watched political news on a flat screen in the dining room. Hotel staff say they've gotten to know these guardsmen and that they've seen different groups cycle through over time.
You guys have a good day now.
In their off time, the Guard in the Rio Grande Valley blend into the community and frequent places like restaurants and gyms. Gym owner Jason Martinez has an arrangement with the hotel next door to accommodate the troops who are staying there. He says he often sees them working out in groups and gestures to a bank of cardio machines behind him.
You got your treadmills, steppers, ellipticals, arc trainers. I seen them one time, they were all there running, you know.
An all-volunteer task force deployed to the Rio Grande Valley about 5 months ago. It includes guardsmen from several states. Georgia National Guard Lieutenant Ashton Griffith is part of it. He came back from Afghanistan last year and has also helped with hurricane relief efforts in his home state.
This is definitely a big change.
Griffith says his unit initially had some concerns about the border assignment, but he says they opened up to it when they learned more about the job and were told their families could come visit from time to time. For some guardsmen, part of the border mission's appeal is military experience. Many of those who deploy take on responsibilities normally reserved for those of higher rank and learn how to coordinate with different agencies.
Coming here was like a broadening assignment for them. They get to learn how the federal government operates, and it also helps them accrue some time and some experience down here in Texas that'll help them not only there, but in the military career.
Griffith, who works as a civilian police officer when not on orders, says life at the border isn't what he expected.
You know, thinking along the border, you think like, oh man, it's Texas, desert, you won't have a lot of things to do. But we came out here and this community is just, it's well built up. You have so many attractions to come stay in the area, and this is a wonderful place to be.
The word is getting out, Griffith says, with more guardsmen wanting to come to the border and serve. This is Carson Frame reporting.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, a destination for bird lovers with Featherfest, guided tours and exhibitions paying homage to the island's rich birding history, including the Lost Bird Project, opening in March. Galveston.com/lostbirds. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm Nathan Bernier in for David Brown. Elizabeth Warren is dropping out of the Democratic presidential primary. She announced the news today first in a phone call with campaign staff. So at its height, the Democratic slate of candidates for the 2020 presidential election was the most diverse ever assembled. Now the race has come down to the leading front runners. Two white men in their late 70s. So in some corners of the party, this has cranked up the volume on calls for a woman to be on the ticket as a vice presidential candidate. And Erin Haynes is writing about it. She's editor-at-large for The 19th, a nonprofit news organization that covers gender and politics. Erin, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
For this story, you spoke with a number of women who are activists, who are voters, who are campaign managers. What case did they make as far as the imperative for Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders to select a running mate who's a woman?
Well, the women that I talked to are frustrated, right? We had the most diverse field that we ever had a year ago as this primary began, including a record 6 women. And, you know, a year later, there is just a vanishing path for any woman. And so with that being the case, you know, they're pivoting and saying, well, if it's not going to be this year for a woman to make history as president, a woman could still make history as vice president. There's never been a woman vice president either. And so two white men on the ticket, period, is really not an option for the majority of the electorate. And they are saying that putting a woman in that position makes sense because somebody on the ticket would be there who has the lived experience of more than half of our population.
Right. Well, from the Democrats he spoke to, I mean, did you get the sense that the VP pick has enough weight to keep them from voting for the Democratic nominee or choosing the Democratic nominee more than even the policies espoused by the candidate?
Well, I think, you know, all Democrats, and that includes women who are Democrats, are saying that their top priority this cycle is defeating Donald Trump. And they feel like the way to do that, the way to oust an incumbent president, and this president in particular, is to really have record turnout, the kind of turnout that comes when voters are energized, when voters are galvanized. And so what are the criteria that are going to do that? And certainly somebody who energizes women is one of the things that Democrats are saying is a way to achieve that. And so putting a woman, but not just any woman, as these people told me, could be a way to potentially really, really energize that part of the party.
Some key words you just said there, not just any woman. Are there names surfacing that seem to be drawing more attention?
Absolutely. So, you know, what I'm hearing is that woman, person of color, preferably both, from a lot of people. And that's from women of all backgrounds. Senator Kamala Harris of California and Stacey Abrams, who ran for the governor of Georgia in 2018 and only narrowly lost her election. Both of those women have a national profile, both dynamic and accomplished Black women whose names keep coming up a lot for that slot. But also, I mean, any of the women who were just in this
most recent 2020 primary cycle. Senator Klobuchar, who just dropped out of the race after South Carolina. Senator Gillibrand, who had to drop out last year. Senator Elizabeth Warren is certainly high on the list for a lot of people. And you know, for the supporters of these women who are disappointed, you know, that they were not able to make it to a nomination, being able to still cast a ballot for them in this way is something that feels not necessarily like a consolation, but it's something that would still make them feel satisfied in this cycle.
Erin Haynes is editor-at-large for The 19th, a nonprofit news organization covering gender and politics. We'll have a link to her Washington Post story on women and the vice presidency at texasstandard.org. Erin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And you're listening to The Texas Standard. We're joined by social media editor Wells Dunbar with the Talk of Texas. What's up, Wells?
That's right, Nathan. Oh, not a lot. Just talking about, folks out there talking about one of the topics we've covered on the show, topic that a lot of folks are talking about, the coronavirus and issues that may arise from it. There, we heard about a couple instances earlier in the show, concerns in Houston, big concerns in Central Texas and Austin over South by Southwest, the big conference and festival slated to show up here, and basically whether or not it should go on. We heard about there's this viral petition that went viral online, calling to cancel the festival. So lots of people chiming in on this. Hearing from folks via Twitter, Mer1, she says, it's one thing to decide to hold South by Southwest. It's another to refuse to refund people who've already bought tickets. Everyone needs to be able to make their own decisions to attend based on health and comfort with risk without being out hundreds or thousands of dollars. And those badges and things can cost a pretty penny.
Yeah,
exactly. Real interesting sort of behind the scenes message here from Kyle Santin via Facebook. He says, realize that yes, it is about the money, referring there to these plans to go ahead with South by Southwest. He writes, for all of us in the events industry, each one of these events that cancels is the equivalent of us losing a month's pay. Some of us are looking at several months without work given the mass number of cancellations. Friends of mine have had their entire calendar cleared out just in the past couple of days.
Wow.
Yeah. So, there's a really interesting article, I think in Texas Monthly recently, I believe by Dan Solomon, talking about sort of gaming out what would happen if South by Southwest really did cancel this year, and just the sort of domino effect that it would have on the local economy, because it really does have a huge impact. But again, people making these decisions, companies making these decisions to back out. So lots of calculus out about there.
Yeah.
Also at the federal level as well, too, the slow rollout of testing kits across the country, and just the way the presidential administration is reacting to that, causing some concern and comments as well. Via Facebook, Doug Ramsey chimes in that as an advanced practice registered nurse, I find it abhorrent that our president continues to downplay the seriousness of this disease in his indifference to his twisted desire to get reelected, Doug writes. He's referring there to remarks this morning from the president on Fox News describing how the country could have thousands or hundreds of thousands of people with the coronavirus and, quote, some of them go to work, but they get better. Directly contradicting advice there to stay
I don't think that's how
home
it works. Yeah.
if you're positive or anything like that. So obviously maybe follow some medical professional advice there.
And there's a lot of advice from the CDC that's been helpful.
Yeah, exactly. You know, people are there is some sort of entertaining content to come out of this. I saw you and I, Nathan, we retweeted the same tweet.
You're talking
at the
about
same
Dom DeFurio?
Yeah, Dom DeFurio from the Dallas Morning News. He tweeted that Tito's Vodka, Central Texas company, Tito's Vodka has spent the last 24 hours explaining to people that it cannot be used as a replacement for hand sanitizer. I guess some good housekeeping article said you can make a DIY hand sanitizer with vodka and aloe vera, but the proof isn't high enough.
Yeah,
you
it's got to be
60%
alcohol.
Like Everclear or something like that. Scary grain alcohol stuff.
That's some expensive hand sanitizer.
Yeah.
Hey, keep up with the news at TexasStandard.org. I'm Nathan Bernier in for David Brown. Thanks for hanging out with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare. The Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.